Let me just remind you where we were when we finished on Monday. We had looked at drugs that were aimed at treating peptic ulcer disease and gastroesophageal reflux. We looked at proton pump inhibitors, H2 receptor blockers, various mucosal protecting agents. We looked at drugs that neutralize the acid that secreted the various antacids. And then finally, we finished by looking at the treatment of the cause of about 80% of gastric ulcers, which is Helicobacter pylori. What I'd like to do today, with your indulgence, if it works, I'd like to just lecture through. I think I have about 60 minutes plus or minus 5 of material, and it'd just make a lot more sense to go straight through than to take a break and disrupt it. So what we are going to look at this morning are two other areas in the GI tract that are of major, in fact, multiple areas. But one is constipation, the other is diarrhea. An interlude between the two is inflammatory bowel disease that can manifest as either diarrhea or constipation. And then we'll look at emesis, and then finally we'll treat your migraine. So the place to begin, or that we're going to pick up the story, is with a discussion of laxatives. The primary treatment for constipation rests on increased dietary fiber, adequate fluid intake, and exercise. And if indeed one can encourage patients to increase the amount of fruit, vegetables, whole grains that they consume, along with adequate fluid, many times this will resolve the constipation. If indeed dietary modification is unable to deal with the constipation, then there are various agents or drugs that can be used to treat. And it's possible to classify these drugs based on how they work. And so I'm going to just give you a few examples. There are multiple examples, but basically the same theme carries through. There are agents that function as irritants or stimulants. Let me give you an example of an agent that functions as an irritant. Castor oil. Castor oil is broken down in the intestine to ricolinic acid, and ricolinic acid is an irritant to the mucosa, which stimulates peristalsis. And there are other examples of irritants, but castor oil and the product of the breakdown, ricolinic acid, being one example. A second is that of a stimulant. There are various plant materials, senna or sennelides, found in Ex-Lax, for example, that contain a substance called Imodium. And these stimulants containing Imodium are administered, and they stimulate colonic activity. The onset is delayed 6 to 8 hours because the substance must be absorbed and then excreted into the intestine, where it functions as a stimulant. Imodium. The Imodium is found in aloe. It's found in senna-based plant materials. There are a variety of plant materials that contain the Imodium, which is the stimulating agent. The adverse effects that one sees with either of these is the ability of these agents to cause abdominal cramping and the potential for the development of an atonic colon in the patient. There are other substances that function as bulking agents to manage and treat constipation. These tend to be hydrophilic colloids, materials derived from plant or vegetable non-absorbable substances. And these colloids, in the presence of water, develop into gels that distend the large intestine and initiate peristaltic activity. There are a number of these bulking agents. One example is psyllium. Another is bran, psyllium being found in Metamucil. They basically work by the same principle. They are hydrophilic colloids. They absorb water. They distend or bulk out, initiating or stimulating the colon to carry out peristalsis and remove the colonic material. There are also substances that are saline or osmotic laxatives. They are typified by magnesium sulfate or Epsom salts, milk of magnesium, magnesium hydroxide. These materials or these osmotic agents function to hold fluid in the colon. So they basically sequester or hold fluid, again distending the colon, stimulating then peristalsis and movement of colonic activity or colonic content. The third approach to constipation is to administer substances that are emulsifying agents. These are surface active emulsifying agents or stool softeners that emulsify the stool products, making for softer feces and ease of passage of the feces. And stool softeners are typified by glycerin that can be even administered as a suppository, mineral oil, and then there are some brand name substances that function in the same way. These various agents have extensive use in the management of constipation that's either drug-induced or disease-induced. And one of the things that you need to be cognizant of is they can alter, any one of these agents can alter the absorption of therapeutic agents that the patient is also taking. If we move from laxatives sort of as an interim to talk about one or two drugs that are used in the management of inflammatory bowel disease. And inflammatory bowel disease really comes in two forms. It comes in the form of ulcerative colitis, and it comes in the form of Crohn's disease. Those are the two major manifestations. Ulcerative colitis is inflammation of the GI mucosa, and it tends to be limited to the colon and the anus. Crohn's disease is inflammation, and it is transmural. It is across the mucosa, and it can occur any place in the GI tract. There are a variety of symptoms associated with either ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease. The patient will have abdominal cramping. The patient may have diarrhea. The patient may, under certain circumstances, have constipation. The presentation varies widely from patient to patient. In general, the patient will experience intermittent attacks. So there will be a period of acute ulcerative colitis or a flare-up of the Crohn's disease followed by some remission or latency of the disorder and then another flare-up. There are a number of substances that are used in the treatment of inflammatory bowel disease. One of the substances that is used to bring about remission during the acute attack are corticosteroids, hydrocortisone being an example thereof. They're able to induce remission of ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease but have been less valuable in maintaining the remission. They are particularly good then at initiating the or reducing the acute attack of the Crohn's disease or the ulcerative colitis. Long-term use of these drugs has considerable toxicity, as you might imagine, and therefore long-term use leads to a whole variety of side effects, so their use is very limited to initiation. Should the patient not respond to the corticosteroid? There are some patients that have developed resistance to corticosteroid treatment. There are various immunosuppressive agents, azathioprine or 6-mercaptopurine that we talked about as an anti-cancer agent, can be used to initiate remission in resistant patients. Now, the key drug here for both the treatment and for maintaining remission, the patient in remission, in both ulcerative colitis as well as in Crohn's disease, is a drug that we mentioned briefly called sulfasalazine. It is a sulfonamide drug. It's a sulfonamide drug that appears to have no antibacterial activity. And this is the structure of sulfasalazine. And this drug is the foundational drug in the therapy of ulcerative colitis. And it has had significant use as well in the treatment of Crohn's disease. It is given orally and it is not well absorbed. About 10% of the drug will be absorbed, but the vast majority of the drug, which is an azide, is retained in the intestine and bacteria cleave it into sulfapyridine and into a substance 5-aminosalicylic acid, or mesalamine as its trade name is known. It is the 5-aminosalicylic acid that is the anti-inflammatory agent, and it's believed to function by inhibition of prostaglandin synthesis. Now, when the drug is cleaved, and about 80% of the drug in the intestine is cleaved by bacteria that cleave this azo linkage, significant amounts of sulfapyridine are absorbed by the patient. And this drug, sulfasalazine, has a high incidence of side effects that are the direct result of sulfapyridine absorption. And the side effects appear to be more prevalent or more pronounced in individuals that are slow acetylators. You remember the sulfonamides are acetylated here by N-acetylation, and that there are individuals that have large amounts of N-acetyltransferase, i.e. are rapid acetylators, and individuals that genetically have lower amounts of the enzyme and are slow acetylators. Those that are slow acetylators are more prone to increased in severity and increased frequency of side effects. And up to 40% of patients will experience side effects. And they run the gamut. They run the gamut from GI problems, nausea, vomiting, to headaches, to arthralgias, myalgias, and a significant percent of patients will have hypersensitivity reactions that are the direct result of the sulfonamide moiety. So although the drug is key and foundational for management of ulcerative colitis and for the management of Crohn's disease, probably up to 40% of patients cannot tolerate it because of the severity of the side effects that are associated with sulfapyridine. Now, there are many other drugs that are used in this disorder of the GI tract, but clearly this is the most important. Once induction of a remission has been initiated. One last class of drugs before we move on to the treatment of vomiting. And that is drugs to manage the opposite, drugs to manage diarrhea. And diarrhea really has two causes in patients. One cause is increased motility of the GI tract. The other cause is decreased absorption of fluids from the GI tract. And there are drugs that are available to target both of these causes. So if we look first at drugs that will decrease the motility of the GI tract, there are two drugs that are available that are used to control diarrhea. One of these drugs is diphenoxylate. We know it as Lomotil. The other is loperamide. We know it as Imodium. And both of these substances function as anti-motility agents. And both of these substances are analogs of the opioid meperidine. And they function, they have opioid-like actions on the gut. They activate presynaptic opioid receptors in the enteric nervous system, which leads to inhibition of acetylcholine release and decreased peristalsis. At the doses that these agents are employed for the treatment of diarrhea, they do not have analgesic effects like the opioids. The side effects that one encounters with these agents includes drowsiness, abdominal cramping, dizziness. Because these agents have the potential for causing a toxic megacolon, that is stopping all peristalsis in the colon, they should not be used in young children or in patients with severe colitis. So one way to manage diarrhea is to slow the motility of the GI tract with agents that are function to block the release of acetylcholine. The other approach that can be used to treat diarrhea is to administer various adsorbents. There are various substances that can be given to a patient, just a few examples, kaolin, pectin, methylcellulose, substances that are not absorbed, but that when entering the GI tract, adsorb, tie up, bind up fluid, and bind up microorganisms, bind up toxins, bind up materials responsible for the diarrhea. They are much less effective than anti-motility agents, and they have the potential for, again, influencing or altering the absorption of many therapeutic agents. So if one had a choice, the choice clearly would be to use one of the anti-motility agents, these being much more effective than the anti-adsorbents. I'd like next to just transition. And in fact, as I was looking over this material, this was probably the place we should have gone right after cancer. And that is one other major problem in the GI tract is emesis, vomiting. And vomiting, as you know, can occur under a variety of conditions. Motion sickness can lead to vomiting. Pregnancy can lead to vomiting. Hepatitis can lead to vomiting. And all of these are unpleasant and difficult for the patient. But it is really nausea and vomiting induced by cancer chemotherapeutic agents that is a major challenge in terms of management. It's estimated that 70 to 80%, and you heard me say over and over and over again, nausea, vomiting, 70 to 80% of people being treated with cancer chemotherapeutic agents will have some degree of nausea and vomiting requiring therapeutic management. Now, there are several factors that influence the incidence and the severity of the vomiting. All vomiting is not created equal here. It is associated with the drug. It is associated with the dose. It is associated with the schedule of treatment. And then there are patient variables. It appears that vomiting is more common in young children and in women than in adults and men. 10 to 40% of patients will experience anticipatory vomiting, vomiting in anticipation of receiving the cancer chemotherapeutic agent. And this can, in some cases, lead to rejection of treatment. In some cases, it leads to dehydration, electrolyte imbalance, nutrient depletion, and a whole variety of serious complications for the patient. Now, in order to understand the drugs that are used to control this, I need to give you at least a quick overview of what is involved in the vomiting or process. What are the sites? What are the inputs into those sites that influence this process? And then the drugs that are used will, I think, become fairly straightforward and clear. There are two sites in the brainstem that have key roles in the vomiting reflex pathway. One of these sites we will come to, the chemoreceptor trigger zone, and the other is the vomiting center. It is the vomiting center that coordinates the events, the motor events associated with vomiting. It is located in the brainstem, in the lateral medullary reticular formation. And it is the vomiting center, rich in dopamine D2 and rich in serotonin 5-HT receptors, that coordinates the process, the motor mechanisms involved in vomiting. So this vomiting center receives inputs from a variety of sources. One of the sources of inputs is from the chemoreceptor trigger zone. This is located in the fourth ventricle in the area postrema. It is outside of the blood-brain barrier. So it is accessible to emetogenic agents in blood and in cerebrospinal fluid. It, too, is rich in dopamine D2 and serotonin H3 receptors. So this site, is accessible to many of the cancer chemotherapeutic agents that patients are receiving being outside of the blood-brain barrier. A second input, and this is a major input into the vomiting center, a second input is the vestibular apparatus or the vestibular system that's involved in motion sickness. And this system provides input to the vomiting center. There are various drugs, histamine H1 receptor antagonists and anticholinergics, scopolamine being an example, that block this process. Drugs that function to block vestibular input have no effect on cancer chemotherapeutic agent-induced emesis. Their effect is limited here. The third input, and a major input, is vagal and enteric afferents in the mucosa of the GI tract. These afferents are rich, or the mucosa is rich in serotonin and rich in 5-HT3 receptors. Activation of these receptors leads to input, both vagal afferent input to the chemoreceptor trigger zone and to the vomiting center. And many drugs that patients receive will irritate the gastric mucosa, result in release of serotonin from enterochromaffin cells that activate these receptors, as will gastritis, microorganisms of various forms of irritants. And then finally, there are cerebral inputs into the vomiting center that play a role in psychiatric disorder-induced vomiting, stress, and anticipatory vomiting. And so there are various inputs into the center that regulates the motor mechanism of vomiting, and various receptors that are prevalent or dominant in these sites, which means there are an array of potential approaches to the inhibition of vomiting at various sites here. What I would like to do is simply talk about the most commonly used, the most potent, and then just give you a little bit of background of other agents. There are many drugs that have other effects beyond their effect on the vomiting center that have other therapeutic agents that you'll encounter when you get into CNS pharmacology. What I'd like to focus on is simply those primary drugs that are used to control vomiting, and that being their sole use. And the drugs we're going to talk about are really shown here in bold. We're going to look at serotonin antagonists and then a couple others, and then briefly mention these minor agents. And as you can see, there are various degrees of potency as anti-emetic agents. And so the place we're going to begin is with a group of drugs called 5-HT3 receptor blockers. There are a number of these agents that have been developed. The poster child, if you like, here, the example that we will use, our reference compound will be ondansetron. It is the first, or was the first, of these introduced. It is an example, and I will simply talk through, try to do this in a generic manner for all the drugs. But if you are ever tested on this, ondansetron will be the tip-off for 5-HT3 receptor blockers. Other agents have been introduced that have slightly improved pharmacokinetic properties, slightly improved efficacy, and slightly improved side effects, fewer side effects. But basically, all of these drugs operate by the same mechanism. And they are probably the top, the primary class of drugs to consider in controlling cancer chemotherapy-induced emesis. They all have fairly long half-lives, somewhere between 4 to 9 hours, which means they can be given once or twice a day. And they function, all of these drugs function at two sites. They function to block 5-HT3 receptors in the chemoreceptor trigger zone and to block 5-HT3 receptors in the vomiting center. The drugs that are used are given either orally or they can be given intravenously prior to the administration of the chemotherapeutic agent. They typically are continued for 3 to 5 days after chemotherapy has been completed. There have been various clinical trials. One of the clinical trials and one of the most emetogenic agents is cisplatin. And these 5-HT3 receptor antagonists will inhibit cisplatin-induced emesis somewhere between 50 to 60%. That is, not only inhibit, but block emesis in the patient. All of these agents, ondansetron being the example, are extensively metabolized by the liver. And so a patient with any kind of hepatic dysfunction, the dose needs to be moderated or modified or reduced. And secondly, the drug and metabolites are eliminated by the kidneys that may also require dose reduction in the presence of renal dysfunction. Headache is the most common side effect that patients experience. They may also, in a small number of patients, encounter constipation and/or diarrhea. These serotonin 5-HT3 receptor blockers also can prolong the QT interval. They have an electrocardiographic effect. They affect the heart. They prolong the QT interval. And this then may put certain patients at risk that have underlying cardiac function or underlying cardiac disorder. There are two other major classes of drugs beyond these that are used to treat emesis. The first class ever to show activity here were a group of compounds called phenothiazines. You'll get to them in 2008. The classic example here is prochlorperazine or compazine as you know it. This is a drug that functions by blocking dopamine D2 receptors in both the chemoreceptor trigger zone and in the vomiting center. It has low to moderate emetogenic activity. One can increase the efficacy of the drug by increasing the dose. The downside of that is one increases then the incidence of side effects. And these can include hypertension and what are referred to as extrapyramidal symptoms of restlessness, dystonia, Parkinson's symptoms or Parkinson-like symptoms. The third major class of anti-emetic agents are a group of substances that are substituted benzamides. An example thereof, and there are many of these, is metoclopramide or Regalin. This also is an agent that is moderately effective against drug cancer chemotherapy-induced emesis. It, like prochlorperazine, functions to inhibit D2 receptors in the chemoreceptor trigger zone in the vomiting center. And the side effects that one sees are similar to what we just described for the phenothiazines. Extrapyramidal effects being the most common, sedation, diarrhea being also encountered. And these are dose dependent. So as one tries to more effectively, by increasing the dose, manage the emesis, one is balancing out side effects. There are three, maybe four other groups of compounds, and I'll give you an example of each, that are used in the treatment of emesis. One of these are a group of compounds, and again, these are almost all of these are CNS agents that you will get to in the second semester. One of these compounds or classes are a group of compounds called butyrophenones. They are antipsychotic agents, basically. An example thereof is droperidol. And it acts, again, by blocking dopamine D2 receptors in the chemoreceptor trigger zone and in the vomiting center. And it has moderate activity as an emetogenic agent or as an anti-emetic agent. It is frequently used in sedation for endoscopy, and it also is frequently combined along with a benzodiazepine for the management of vomiting. Now, benzodiazepines represent another class of drugs that have a role here, a potential role here. Although their effectiveness is fairly low in terms of preventing vomiting, they have sedative, angiolytic, and amnesic properties that make them useful. And so they're useful, again, in combination to blunt anticipatory emesis and to reduce certainly the anxiety on the part of the patient. The next group are corticosteroids. An example thereof is dexamethasone. It is mild to moderate in terms of its emetogenic inhibitory activity. It is used in combination with other agents, and its mechanism is thought to involve inhibition of prostaglandin synthesis. It can cause insomnia. It can cause hyperglycemia in patients that have diabetes. Yeah, it can cause hyperglycemia in patients that have diabetes. It can exacerbate the hyperglycemia, and it can cause insomnia in patients. Yeah.
A few of these you said both they are emetic agents and they are anti-emetic
agents. I misspoke if I said that. Yeah. They're all anti-emetic agents.
Where did the
benzodiazepines work? They work primarily by different mechanisms, none of which directly on vomiting, more to reduce anxiety on the part of the patient, and How do they do that? They work through a class of receptors called GABA receptors. You'll get all of this in the second semester. Okay. They're primarily anti-anxiety agents that reduce the level of anxiety in the patient. Yeah. They are useful not directly on the vomiting center or the chemoreceptor trigger zone, but rather to reduce anxiety. They seem to be working at the higher levels that are providing input, and they have a clear effect on reducing anticipatory vomiting.
Did you say that about the
hormone? Nope, I only said it about benzodiazepines. Okay? And it's hard to sort of give you a complete picture on drugs that you haven't encountered yet. So basically, this is just to try to give you examples of each and how they're used without becoming burdensome. The last group are ones that you've probably heard about, and that is cannabinoids or marijuana derivatives. These have some moderate activity in preventing vomiting. They are seldom first-line drugs, and they have significant number of dose-related side effects that include dysphoria, hallucinations, sedation, disorientation, etc., etc. They are rarely... Yeah, can you get them? Yeah, you can get them two ways. Okay, one way you know, the other way is by prescription. Okay. But they're really not first-line drugs. And so those people out there waving the flag saying we got to have these to smoke in order to relieve our whatever, you know. Let me just come back now and try to put this in some kind of a perspective. We've talked about many things, but there really are three classes of drugs, the three major ones you need to be aware of. These drugs frequently are used in combination. Just as cancer drugs are used in combination, the complexity of emesis is such that drugs are used in combination to manage it. One such example is to use the 5-HT3 receptor blocker along with dexamethasone. If you say, how does this lead to increased efficacy, I know not, but probably through the multiple mechanisms that each use to block the effect. So multiple drugs from this list and the primary drugs are used in managing this disorder. Clearly at the top of the list are serotonin 5-HT3 receptor blockers. For milder, less severe, the other two agents are appropriate, phenothiazines and benzamides. Okay? Now, if you do not have one, this might be a good spot to just take a break and pass this. If you have done the evaluation, would you just please initial your name? And that's worth 4 points. One last subject for 2007, okay? Yes?
I was wondering, SSRIs, one of their main side effects, emesis?
No, it's not. No. Did I say emetogenic? All of these frittin' drugs block. Okay? I'm sorry if I confused. Okay. One last subject, and there is somewhat of a theme here, and that is we're going to consider migraine headaches, and we're going to consider drugs that are used to treat migraine headaches. And just to give you some background on migraines, it's estimated that about 18 million women and 6 million men suffer from migraines, severe migraines. So it's clearly has a preference to females or for females. And it's possible to distinguish migraines in terms of a variety of criteria from other kinds of headaches, specifically cluster headaches and tension headaches. And if you just turn the page, you will see an example of these. And what I'd like to do is just talk through some of the features associated with a tension headache, a cluster headache, and then migraine, and that's where we'll spend our time. Tension headaches typically have a familiar or a genetic link to them. They occur more frequently in females than in males. They normally, the onset is related to stress in the life of the individual. They typically involve both sides of the head, both sides, and there is a dull, persistent, pressing type of experience associated with the tension headache. They variable in terms of their duration from 30 minutes to days, and they can be treated. And the drugs that are used to treat are muscle relaxant or relaxing agents as well as the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. The cluster headaches have no genetic basis. They occur in males more than females. They typically happen during sleep, and they occur behind or around one eye, producing sharp, steady pain, and they tend to be, by comparison, relatively short in duration. And usually, they are associated with a variety of symptoms: sweating, facial flushing, nasal congestion, etc. Cluster headaches are treatable using the same drugs that we're going to talk about for the treatment of migraine. Migraine headaches, on the other hand, appear to have some genetic predisposition or familial basis. The onset is variable. They can occur while awake. They can occur while sleeping. There is not a clear triggering mechanism. The location is usually one side of the brain. The characteristics are pulsing, throbbing, severe pain. The duration can be hours to days, depending on the episode. The frequency of episodes will vary from patient to patient, and there are a variety of symptoms associated. Visual auras, sensitivity to light and sound. The patient will experience nausea and vomiting, and there may be changes in facial appearance as well. The pathophysiology of migraine headache or migraine disorders is not completely understood, but what is understood is that migraines are the result of trigeminal neurovascular dysfunction. And this can be triggered by stress, by fatigue, by hunger, by various substances circulating in the blood derived from food or drugs. Now, about 15% of patients that have migraines experience auras. And these auras can be visual, that is, they experience an aura prior to the onset of the migraine headache. And these auras can be visual, that is, they can take the form of brightly flashing lights or rippling images, and they typically last 10 to 15, or let's say 15 to 20 minutes. They can also be sensory, that is, tingling of the hands, arms, shoulders, trunk. A migrating paresthesia can occur in some of the patients. The auras are believed to be the result of cerebral vasoconstriction and ischemia. About the vast majority, 85% of patients that have migraine attacks do not experience an aura, but may very well experience or become sensitive to light, sensitive to sounds, and experience some nausea with or without vomiting as part of the onset of the attack. The headache itself, the migraine itself, with or without an aura, is identical. So these are prodromal, or these are events that occur. And just draw the sequence. In the sequence of events, in the time course of the migraine attack, there is clearly this asymptomatic phase that can vary from patient to patient. Then there's this prodromal phase, this period, 15, 20 minute period, that may have associated with it visual disturbances, sensory disturbances, that is due to vasoconstriction, and then there is the attack. This may be associated with auras, this may not. Now, at the heart of migraine and at the heart of treatment is the neurotransmitter serotonin. And just to quickly review for you, serotonin, and then we'll talk about the drugs that are used to treat. Serotonin, as you know, or 5-hydroxytryptamine, comes from the essential amino acid tryptophan that becomes hydroxylated. This is the rate-limiting step in the synthesis, and then decarboxylated to 5-hydroxytryptamine. There are various serotonergic receptors. These have been classified. We've talked about one, serotonin 5-HT3, which is associated with nausea and vomiting. And now our focus is going to be on the class of serotonin receptors that are very much involved in migraine, that are the targets for drugs that are used to treat migraine. And this is a subset of serotonin receptors that are 5-HT1D1B. So if indeed serotonin is involved, and if indeed the migraine attack with or without an aura is identical, then what is responsible? What is the progression of the migraine, the attack itself? And perhaps the easiest way to describe this is to break it into pieces for you. I've done part already. It's possible to describe a migraine from onset to the headache in two phases. There is this first or prodromal phase, and it is associated with cerebral vasoconstriction and ischemia that's mediated by serotonin. That's the photophobia, the phonophobia, the auras. The headache itself, the actual headache, is the result of cerebral vasodilatation that leads to the pain, the throbbing, the pulsing. And this is mediated by the release of substance P and by the release of a second compound called calcitonin gene-related protein. I said that migraine headaches are the result of trigeminal neurovascular dysfunction. So let me describe for you what is believed to be involved in the precipitation of the headache. That will then set up how the drugs that are used to disrupt the attack function. And this is shown on this page. All of these dark spots, triangle or squares, are serotonin 5-HT1B1B receptors. Here's what's thought to be involved in the attack. Activation of brainstem trigeminal complex here leads to the release of peptides, substance P and calcitonin gene-related protein. And these peptides then go and circulate to plea and dural vessels in the brain, leading to vasodilatation and inflammation. These are peptides that are released that lead to vasodilatation and inflammation, and that triggers then nociceptive fibers of the trigeminal nerve becoming activated, and that is responsible for the pain associated with the headache. Trigeminal nerve activation releases peptides that cause vasodilatation and inflammation in plea and dural vessels that trigger nociceptive trigeminal receptors, leading to pain. The drugs that we're going to talk about, of which there are two primary drugs, okay, for the disruption, the intervention in the migraine attack, all are agonists of these receptors. Here, here, and here. All of these drugs are going to reverse the effects of the peptides. So they're going to lead to vasoconstriction. They're going to result in inhibition of release, and they're going to result in inhibition of activation of the trigeminal nerves. And there are two major groups of drugs that are used to treat migraine. One of the drugs, classes of drugs, and you will run into this again in the second semester, are a group of drugs called ergot alkaloids. And there are a number of ergot alkaloids. They are derived from a fungus that grows on rye called Claviceps purpurea. The primary drug is a drug called dihydroergotamine. And dihydroergotamine is one of the drugs used to disrupt the migraine attack. And how does it work? Well, it works on serotonin 5-HT1B1B receptors. And so it works at various sites. Activation of these receptors in cerebral blood vessels leads to vasoconstriction. Stimulation of the presynaptic 5-HT1B1 receptor on the trigeminal nerve ending leads to inhibition of peptide release. And stimulation of 5-HT1B1 receptors in the brainstem prevents activation of the trigeminal nerves involved in the migraine headache. Dihydroergotamine is a compound that is most effective when it is given early in the attack. It is available both for injection as well as intranasal or inhalation administration. The injectable preparations are more rapid, they're more reliable, they can be subcutaneous, they can be intramuscular, rarely are they intravenous. When dihydroergotamine is given, it is frequently administered with metoclopramide metoclopramide, the anti-emetic, because dihydroergotamine initiates or causes nausea and vomiting. The side effects that one sees in using this compound include clearly nausea and vomiting, some muscle cramping. It is also capable of causing peripheral vasoconstriction and stimulating vascular smooth muscle. It is clearly contraindicated in persons with coronary artery disease or peripheral vascular disease. The other major group of drugs to inhibit or block migraine headaches are a group of drugs called triptans. These are the most recent entries into the field. There are a number of these. I picked one. Sumatriptan, you may know it as Imitrex. There are about four or five of these that are currently available. They literally all have the same basic pharmacology, so I will simply share that with you. The newer drugs, again, having improved pharmacokinetics, maybe slightly improved efficacy, maybe better or less risk of remission or recurrence on the part of the patient. They all work by the same mechanism. In fact, the mechanisms by which the triptans work is identical to the mechanism that I just described for dihydroergotamine, blocking the trigeminal nerve activation, release of peptides at the blood vessel, stimulating vasoconstriction. The triptans can be given, again, parenterally. Patients can take them subcutaneously, administer them intramuscularly. There is even a nasal or an intranasal form of the drug. The injectable or parenteral has a fairly prompt response. Patients will respond in about 20 minutes. It's very important in a migraine headache. The oral form of the drug, the onset of effect is somewhere in 1 to 2 hour range. The clinical effectiveness of these agents suggests that about 85% of patients will respond. That is, in about 85% of patients, triptans are capable of terminating the migraine attack. They are slightly superior to dihydroergotamine. There are a group of patients, somewhere 10 to 20% of patients, that will not respond to the triptan drugs. And about 40% of patients that respond, where the headache is terminated, will have a recurrence of the headache the same day. Recurrences are more prevalent in patients who have more severe attacks, in patients that have longer attacks. The recurrence can be treated with a second dose of triptan drug. And as I indicated, if sumatriptan is the first, the related drugs simply have improved ability to terminate the attack and to diminish the recurrence. The side effects include a number of, by and large, tolerable minor effects. There's patients that will experience tightness of the chest, weakness, inability to sleep, dizziness. It's hard to know how much is drug-induced, because if you look at clinical studies, about 50% of patients will have these side effects, and about 30% of individuals that are on placebo will experience the same side effects. All of the triptans have this same complex of side effects. One of the things that they will do and can do is that they can cause abnormal tingling and burning sensations of the skin. These are benign, although they can be alarming to the patient. And all of these triptans can cause coronary vasospasm and should not be used in patients that have angina or have had myocardial infarcts or suffer coronary artery disease. So clearly in the pecking order, the triptan drugs are the current drug of choice for the treatment of migraine. Not all patients respond. Recurrences occur during the same initial attack that necessitate readministration of the drug. But they've had a significant effect, both of these drugs, on management of migraine that is serotonin-mediated by a two-step process. That is it. I have enjoyed immensely teaching you. You've been a great class. And what I've appreciated the most is you have your tush in your seat at 8 o'clock. So we can start on time and I don't have to cheat at the end to get through material. And you've been just a pleasure for me to teach, and I wish you the very best as you continue on in your education here in medical sciences. So why don't you take a break before Dr. Braun gets his on you, okay?
And as he probably already told you, he can hardly wait to see you.